If you are looking to elevate your leadership and drive your nonprofit forward, I invite you to subscribe to the Successful Nonprofits newsletter. Every week, I curate exclusive, shareworthy content that sparks inspiration, innovation, and conversation. From the latest trends to timeless advice, the weekly email newsletter is your all-access pass to a treasure trove of resources. But receiving the newsletter is not just about staying informed. It's also about getting our best content first. Subscribers get first access to our newest downloadable templates designed to propel your leadership and amplify your impact. And that's not all, my friend. We are constantly working on new ways to support you and your mission. So as a subscriber, you'll get updates on our latest projects, opportunities to participate in surveys, and a say in the topics that we tackle next. You will essentially get me as a consultant, coach, and confidant in your inbox, ready to help you navigate the challenges of nonprofit leadership. So if you're an executive director, board chair, or a nonprofit leader who believes in making a difference, join me as a newsletter subscriber. Visit successfulnonprofits.com/newsletter to sign up today. And now, friend, let me take you to the episode you've downloaded. Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. Friends, today's episode, we are going to be talking about ridding your organization of obstacles that infuriate everyone. And it might surprise you because we also might be talking about maybe some good friction as well. So if you are tired of that expense reimbursement form that takes 25 minutes to complete and requires multiple approvers for like a simple $5 expense, or if your eyes bleed when you receive that 1,200-word email, by the way, this is not the first time they sent you a 12 or 1,800-word email that really isn't about anything that's important at all, well, my friend, then this episode is for you. Today, Huggy Rao is going to be on the show, and he co-wrote the book, The Friction Project. I got to tell you, I barely finished reading that book a few weeks ago and have already gifted it to a few clients. It is that incredibly good. Now, Huggy also co-authored the book, The Scaling Up Excellence, and also the book, Market Rebels. So, and let me just share with you, those books did phenomenally well. We're talking Wall Street Journal bestsellers, Business Book of the Year, etc. So clearly, Huggy is an expert in this. He also is a professor of organizational behavior at Stanford Business School, and his teaching specialties include organizational change, customer-focused cultures, and organizational design. Additionally, Huggy has consulted with for-profits, nonprofits, and government agencies that are household names. When I say household names, I mean things like IBM, American Cancer Society, and the CIA. Hey, Huggy, welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here this afternoon from Stanford, California, Dolph. And thank you for setting the stage so crisply and so wonderfully.
Thank you. I have to tell you, I had never heard of the concept of a frustration factory until I read your book.
You know, you really keyed in on something very critical, and that's one of the motivations why that underlay this book. Earlier, as you implied in your introductory message, Bob and I had written a book called Scaling Up Excellence. Top and senior echelons of leadership in organizations for and nonprofit like the message and the ideas. But as we went lower down, what people seemed to say both in nonprofit and for-profit organizations was, it's hard to get anything done. Your allusion to the frustration factory was when I asked a participant in an executive education program whose nameplate wasn't there, where do you work? With a glint in his eye, he said, a frustration factory. That's where he worked. And you can immediately visualize what life in a frustration factory is. You go with high energy, you come back drained and kind of exhausted. In fact, another young woman whom I can never forget, she said this with a quiver in her voice, and I think a tear in her eye as well, when she said, you know, I go home exhausted and all I've got left are scraps of myself for my family. And that was a punch to the gut. And you kind of say, my God, we really need to understand what is happening in terms of the specifics of the world of work. And thus began our adventure, and to focus initially on obstacles that enrage, overwhelm, infuriate employees and other members and other constituencies. But as we began the journey that way, Dolph, we also discovered obstacles can slow down, educate, and foster deliberation too. So our realization was, you know, if friction simply is defined as obstacles, it can be bad if it infuriates, enrages, all of that. And it can be good when it slows down and educates people. In that sense, friction is kind of very much like the bacteria in our microbiome. We have good and bad bacteria. We have good and bad cholesterol. And such is the same with friction in organizations.
I was struck by that in your book, where you really did go into detail. Originally, you thought you were going to be writing a book, I think, just about, oh, friction is bad. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. There's some good friction. I'm glad it exists.
Absolutely. That was kind of a little bit of a surprise to us, because most of us kind of simply think obstacles are hassles, you know, or hoops to run through or endure or, you know, what have you. And that's kind of a very one-sided view. So it's very funny that people tell you stories of obstacles that frustrate, et cetera. And then when you look at successful founders and those who bootstrap themselves, they're all sagas of overcoming obstacles that slowed down, educated, built muscle and fiber and so on, you know. And so the reason this is all important, particularly for leaders, irrespective of whether you lead a team in a nonprofit, whether you lead a department, a division, you know, whether you lead an alliance, whatever level of leadership you're in, the key thing to understand always is our job is twofold. On the one hand, as leaders, we need to make sure we're creating the right conditions where people can choose a more curious and generous version of themselves. By the same token, we also have to make sure we prevent people from choosing overconfident and myopic version of themselves. So when you want to prevent people from embracing overconfidence and myopia, that's where obstacles that slow down, educate, foster deliberation, and search really become important. On the other side, when we want to enhance curiosity, and we want to enhance generosity, because it's very hard to help people when you're overwhelmed by obstacles that infuriate you and so on. If it's okay with you, Dolph, dive just a little deeper in and maybe begin with bad friction. What we kind of realized was, as the remarks I gave you about the young lady with a tear in her eye and the guy who said who worked in a frustration factory, what they're telegraphing is, we suffer from time poverty. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just have 24 hours a day. You know, we've got our roles at home and at work and, you know, in the community, and that's all you got, and you have to sleep and you have to restore and you have to do all of these things.
I just have to pause for a second and think about that, because I think you're right. We do suffer from time poverty, but yet we've never had so many time-saving devices in the history of humanity. Like, to me, that's what's so ironic. Like, everyone's like, I don't have enough time. You know, washing your clothes used to be an all-day affair. And now you throw them in a machine and you go do other things while your clothes are washing.
You certainly make an excellent point in noticing an irony. However, the thing is, it's not the time poverty itself, it's a necessary condition. It's not sufficient for bad friction. The other condition that you need is, and this is being recently discovered and discussed, is the addition bias that pervades all of us human beings. Mm-hmm. In any situation, instead of simplifying, we add. It's very interesting when you look at the difference between novices and experts, for example, in experimental studies. A novice leather buyer might actually mentally have many more categories of leather, whereas an expert leather buyer actually has far fewer categories.
Hmm.
Because they've seen a bigger probability distribution of events. Each new event doesn't require a category. They begin to see, you know, broader kind of and sharper categorization. So that's like one example. So the addition bias is so pervasive. One report in Nature, which was a review of 20 studies, showed that in every single case, it didn't matter what you did. Please build a Lego model. People added more ideas than most. Things to do than to subtract things. Let's plan a vacation. Well, you add more things than subtract them. And finally, let's actually think of improve reforming a university. And in that study, they found that 89% of the suggestions had to do with additions and only 11% had to do with subtraction. So you've got time poverty, you've got this deluge of addition. And what you have is you have people being overwhelmed. And when you're overwhelmed, the first thing you're going to say is, man, I don't have the bandwidth to do this. So curiosity goes for a toss. And then you just say, I'm too exhausted to help anybody. And generosity kind of goes by the wayside. And as you know, nonprofits in particular rely on both curiosity and generosity. You're not curious about your clients. You're not curious about your members, you're not curious about your constituencies. How can you organize, channel, and structure generosity? Hmm. It's very hard to do that effectively. So that's kind of the problem we see in the world of bad friction.
I have to share with you, I knew from almost the very beginning, first couple of pages of your book, I was going to love your book. Because you described, and by the way, this is in the first few pages, and then it's probably under the Oblivious Leader section as well. You describe doing something that I feel confident I've done as a leader. You describe someone at a university that sent out a really, really long email with an even longer attachment. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, and I'm so glad, Dolph, you found the first few pages engaging, because what we want, Bob and I wanted to do in the first few pages was to really invite people into a conversation immediately. And the way to invite people into a conversation is to get real very quickly. Otherwise, you're just kind of talking in kind of abstractions. And what happened was Stanford at that time was creating a new school of sustainability. And the vice provost in charge of that initiative, very inclusive individual, she wants to invite faculty. I don't doubt her intention for a moment. But the execution was kind of like mystifying, because the vice provost was asking us, please volunteer two Saturdays of yours to help us brainstorm about the School of Sustainability. Wonderful overture, signaling I want to hear. But the mode of execution was weird. You had to wade through an email with close to 1,250 words. I mean, that is a long email. And then you had to wade through another 70 to 100 word attachment. And just the processing the invitation itself exhausts you. And you have the problem there. Bob, who certainly is a more gifted writer than I am, immediately shortened her message to, I think, far fewer words. He's just very good at cutting down, pruning, and so on and so forth. And of course, fired off a reply to the vice provost's boss, the provost. Nobody makes deposits of time. They're all in the withdrawal business. And if everything is a withdrawal from the bank of time, well, guess what?
Right, right.
You got to put in, you got to deposit too in the bank if you have to kind of survive and thrive. And that's sort of the a big challenge. And, you know, removing bad friction, it's not like some gigantic thing. It could start with something super simple. One of the examples we have in the book actually is at Hawaii Pacific, a healthcare organization in Hawaii. And Melinda Ashton, the physician there, was fed up with the electronic patient record system. And she started a campaign called Get Rid of Stupid Stuff. Now, they got 187 targets identified, which were suggested by people as sources as stupid stuff that needed to be gotten rid of. But just because I think it's stupid doesn't mean it's necessarily stupid. One person's bad friction may be another person's good friction. So we need to kind of think of those spillovers. Anyway, when they looked at all the spillover effects, what they found was some 85 plus opportunities to make changes. And one of the changes, Dolph, was simply reducing a couple of keystrokes for nurses. So this is an enterprise with 4 hospitals, lots of nurses, lots of patients. And when you totaled all of this up, it amounted to $1,700 nursing hours a month.
Wow.
Just imagine that.
Yeah, I've got to do some quick math. That's like 40 weeks of a nurse's time every month.
There you go.
Wow. Which reminds me of something that you said in your book that really hit home with me. And I think, you know, most of my friends who are listening are leaders in their organization. I think it's going to hit home with them. And that's, as leaders, we're the trustees of other people's time.
Completely. Because we all talk about respecting people. You know, Dolph, don't you think that a concrete way in which I would respect you is to respect your time?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I just cannot fathom why people do not operationalize respect for the person as respect for the person's time. It's like respecting an individual doesn't simply mean saying, I don't want to hurt your feelings. You know, it's a lot more than that, I think. It's like, I'm going to value your time. And I don't want to piss it away. I don't want to waste it away. Instead, I want to focus it. I want to channel it. And I think the moment we see ourselves as the trustee of other people's time, part of what we do is we then kind of think as leaders, we can then think of where do I take out bad friction and make the right things easy to do? Where do I put in good friction to make the wrong things harder to do? But let me finish with bad friction and I'll just get to good friction in a moment. So our favorite phrase, and this is something all nonprofit leaders ought to think about, is getting rid of bad friction is not a one and done thing. Getting rid of bad friction is exactly like mowing the lawn. And you have to mow the lawn regularly. You don't do it episodically. You don't do it once in a while. And the problem in organizations is nobody mows the lawn. There's no department whose job it is to mow the lawn. So nobody thinks about mowing the lawn. And if you don't mow the lawn, weeds are going to overrun the place. But then everybody wants to add new saplings to the lawn. And you're thinking, you can add as many saplings as you want to the lawn, but they're going to be outcompeted by the weeds. And there lies the problem. There lies the problem. By the same token, you can create good friction in the simplest of ways. So often what you can do is you can actually use good friction to reduce bad friction. So somebody wants to add something, you quickly say, great, what is it you're going to subtract? Or you'll actually say, hey, what if you had half the resources? And I think you know, we really need to automatically think of doing this. The problem, so a lot of the times you need the kind of balance, you know, of making sure you have the bad friction and you kind of subtract that. And you got to have like some process that kind of makes sure you put in the good friction necessary. And good friction can take any shape. It could be a pause, like, for example, Andreessen Horowitz, a venture capital company here in the Bay Area, when the investment committee meets, it's a 5-person investment committee, Dolph. The norm is if all 5 people agree, they're never going to put money in the venture. Because the implication is, hey, that was like too quick. It's easy to agree. And if it's so easy to agree, if you think it's a great idea, somebody else has already done it, we don't know about it, or they're doing it and we don't know about it. And the other thing is maybe you didn't do due diligence. Because, you know, quick agreement is like a suspect kind of entity, right? And so, but if you disagree, it means you've like thought of alternative points of view. You've like worked at it. And the other thing, of course, is new ventures in their case are disruptive innovations, and disruptive innovations are controversial. And that ought to be reflected in the voting pattern. So That's why we call it a project. It's always taking the bad friction out. It's inserting the good friction. And now, where should you insert good friction is a very good question. So what our sort of suggestions are is, whenever a nonprofit organization is making a difficult to reverse decision, you know, you can call them one-way door decisions, that's when you need to slow down. That's kind of when you need to actually have obstacles that educate.
So if I could ask, as an example, if my nonprofit is merging with another nonprofit, would that be a one-way door?
That's like a brilliant example. That is because it's very difficult to reverse. And that's kind of where you have to slow down. And it's kind of really interesting when the nonprofits merge together, as you sort of point out. The question is, what's the quality of due diligence that you do?
Right, right.
And it's not just financial exposure. It's not just like lists of cultural values. It's like, how do these people kind of operate? What do they do? And once you do the due diligence, for example, when I teach classes in mergers and acquisitions, one of the things I tell people is, buddy, your due diligence of a merger should at least identify a minimum of 25, maybe 25 projects where teams from both sides can work together quickly and achieve results in 100 days. And it could be the simplest thing, improving the time taken to pick up the phone to God knows what. You know, you can choose whatever. And the reason you need these things is, you know, getting those results is, you of course need to do all of that, but you have to identify all of this before. So before close, as they say, you have to identify these 100-day opportunities, and identifying that is a case of like making sure you're putting good friction in. Otherwise, you're probably going to make a wrong decision. And after you close, people have work to do. And when people don't have work to do and they're waiting and they're confused, that's when the situation is rife for rumors. But the other thing I really feel this 100-day project identification in the earliest stages of due diligence is post-close, you get a lovely example from people from both sides of the house to work together. Contact diminishes prejudice. When you and I don't have anything to do and we don't do anything, that's kind of when prejudice enters the equation, right? But you have contact. How can that be the case? A lovely example.
Another one I think about, although I get it's really a two-way door, I also think about like hiring someone, because in most organizations, it's far, far easier to hire someone than it is to get rid of someone who maybe you should not have hired.
Absolutely. Again, slowing down is like the important thing. You know, the whole process of hiring. I'm astonished. The other day, I was teaching a bunch of executives, many of whom have been hired many times, promoted many times. I said, in any of the job interviews, has anybody asked you these questions? What did you make easy for your team members to do and why? What did you make harder for your team members to do and why? And they looked at me and said, no. Nobody has ever asked us.
Really? Wow.
Now, what does that tell you?
Yeah, it kind of tells you that the organizations they're going to are not really thinking about really how they're supporting the people who work for them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
The thing that you want also, since you've like raised the question of hiring, the other day we had a remarkable guest in our class. He's a very well-known person, you know. His name is Bing Gordon. He used to be the, you know, lead director at Amazon for many years, partner at Pliner. And he was challenging our students. And he said, you know, the first thing you got to do is you got to kill job descriptions, he said. And they said, why? And he said, because they're meant for the average person. So his argument was, when you write a job description, you should be writing it as though you're reviewing an A-plus player.
Absolutely. So let's talk, though, about those two-way doors, because I know we've not talked about those two-way door decisions yet.
So two-way door decisions are very easy to kind of reverse decisions. Put another way, the cost of a mistake is very low. That's what basically a two-way door decision is. It could be something sort of as trivial as having a brainstorming meeting, you know, the ideas you kill in the brainstorming meeting killing is the idea after you brainstorm is the most important thing. But the point is, you don't want to put too many constraints on people early on. You want them to flare out. You want simply a large number of ideas. You're not necessarily kind of interested in the quality of ideas. You worry about that at a later stage. That's like an example of like a simple thing. So, you know, it's interesting. We had a wonderful discussion yesterday in my Stanford MBA class with two incredible people who founded a company called Devoted Health. And Devoted Health, as the name shows, it's like really fascinatingly done. But look at how simple things are, how you take out bad friction, but you put in good friction. So Devoted Health's premise is the U.S. healthcare system is screwed up. Of course, they use more colorful language, you know. And, you know, what they want to do is they want to kind of unscrew up the healthcare system. So they've got lots of things. They've got their own insurance plan. They've got their own navigator and on and on and on, all for elderly patients. And the idea is the earlier the care you give, the later, the better the long-term savings. They saved, for example, Medicare about 40%. You know, for the group of people that they were looking after. So the founder, Todd Park, a remarkable person, you know, he was both he and the other person, DJ Patil, the DJ, as we all call him, they were all in the White House. I think one of them was the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, Park. The other was the Chief Data Officer, DJ. And all of them got together along with Todd's brother, Ed, to build Devoted Health. And the most interesting thing in Devoted Health, Dolph, is what they call the primary directive. They have one. And the one primary directive for everybody, when you're making a decision about a patient, pause and ask yourself, what would you do if this person were your mother or father? Okay? That is the single most important question you got to ask.
So that pause would be good friction, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you figure out like what to do for your mom and dad? Of course, all of us would figure out what to do. But this is the interesting point. Now you don't need to educate anybody. Everybody gets it. What you want to do is scale belief in your commitment that that's going to happen. Because people are going to say, really? You think I can actually spend so much money now because we're going to get a long-term gain? And that's kind of where you have to show them that happens. And the way you do that is through stories. The more stories people hear, the more they can say, yeah, you know, people do treat patients like they would treat their mom or dad. I can do that too. And now the organization is completely focused on one thing. Do I need to give you a job description once I give you this prime directive? You tell me, Dolph.
You're right. You don't. You absolutely don't.
And for our nonprofit friends in the audience, the question they need to be thinking about is, what is going to be the prime directive in my nonprofit?
Mm-hmm. That's a game-changing question. That is literally, Huggy, that's a game-changing question.
I'm so glad you feel that way. Instead, what do people do? They just kind of have PowerPoints and then they want to roll a change out and they want to get buy-in. And people most of the time don't even know what the hell they're talking about. You know, when you translate it as simply as Todd did, you know, the one primary directive, that is it. That is the single most important thing for you. Everything else, you improvise, you change, you do. And you hear stories that reinforces and scales the belief. In the end, that is what is actually going to help nonprofits to scale. It's not the number of volunteers they have. It's not the number of members they have. It's like, how clear are they about the single most important thing to do?
That's powerful. And that's a good segue into friction fixing, because that prime directive helps us cut through friction. There's one last thing about friction fixing that I really wanted to just touch on. I loved this line in your book, and I'm going to read it. It's very short. Friction fixing is fueled by civility, caring, and love.
Well, I'm glad that that sentence kind of leapt out at you. You truly are a discerning reader. You know, and I'm going to channel Todd Park again. you know, and others like him. In the end, what you need is friction fixing isn't logistics only. It's logistics multiplied by love. You know, because if you've got only logistics, I want efficiency and I want this and I want that and all that, you know, you may get it, but it's not going to kind of be long-lasting, the impact. You need to multiply the logistics with the love. On the other hand, if all that you got is love and no logistics, you know, you got no follow-through.
Right, right. I have to share with you, I never thought I would hear a Stanford Business School professor say, logistics multiplied by love. You just warmed my heart in a way that you could never imagine. That's awesome.
Thank you so very much, Dolph. You know, I have to thank a number of people in the healthcare field, like, you know, Todd and DJ and another entrepreneur called Jeff Spite. And that's sort of what they all do. And that's kind of what they all think. But you need love at the beginning. And then that's the pathway into logistics. And then when both kind of get multiplied, you know, look at this prime directive. You've simplified the logistics enormously. And, you know, like you were alluding to, you don't need to run up like an approval ladder and you don't need to kind of socialize and like do whatever. Do it.
Right. Well, Hagi, there's one thing I'd love to do with you, and I do this with all of our guests, and I love to play two truths and a lie with our guests. So if you'd like to share two truths about yourself and a lie, don't tell me which one's the lie. I'm going to try to guess it. And by the way, this is how you will know that I've been scammed a couple times in my life. I'm terrible at this game. All righty. So if you've got two truths and a lie, I'd love to hear them.
Two truths and a lie. Okay. I love research and reading and all of these things. I like cooking, you know, cooking different kinds of food from different parts of the world. I love swimming.
Okay, I know for a fact you do like reading and research. I know that to be a fact. I've read your books. I can tell that. So now I have to decide, is it cooking or is it swimming? And I should say that cooking is the other truth, but I'm not. I could see you as a swimmer.
Well, you know, very good try. very good try. Cooking and not swimming.
Cooking. Yeah, it's funny. Like, I could picture you in the kitchen, but I'm like, but I could also see Hagi, like, really loving to swim. Okay.
Yes, I mean, wow. I do. You know, actually, I'm afraid of swimming at some level.
And no way, you know, really.
So, the interesting thing is the reason I'm kind of afraid of swimming is when I was a young kid, it was a long time ago in India, a friend of mine actually drowned. And,
oh, wow.
You know, I got to tell you, you know, it's like a very powerful impact it has. But on the other hand, I should tell you, my wife loves beach vacations and we do go to the beach and she swims and I wade around for a little while in the water and bleat when she goes too far away into the ocean.
So I'll share with you, I don't swim. I don't know how to swim. My husband is an Ironman, which means, you know, I think that's like a 2-something mile swim,
oh my
100
God.
And something mile bike ride, and then a marathon on top of that. But so he can swim two miles open water in the ocean. And two things about this. The first is every now and then, one of his Ironman friends will say, oh, Dolph, when are you going to do a triathlon? And my response is, never, because I can't swim and I'm not going to drown. But then the other thing, I've experienced that, exactly what you're talking about, where like, I'll see Frank, we'll be at the beach and he'll go out and out and eventually I can't see him anymore. And that's when I'm very nervous. Like
You're similar in that regard. There you go.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Hagi, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so grateful that you did. Before I let you go, I have to make sure that my friends who are listening know how to learn more about you. So friends, you can go to Huggy's website. That's huggyrao.com. And while you are there, you can check out, because I spent some time there over the last couple of weeks, you can check out all of his books. He's got TED Talks posted, other podcasts that he has been on. You also can see articles that he's written. So please make sure you go to huggyrao.com. You also can purchase his book, The Friction Project, at the Macmillan website. We'll have that that in the show notes. But if you're an Amazon Prime member and you don't like fiction, you could probably pick it up there. We'll link to Huggy's LinkedIn page in the show notes. And Huggy has a co-author on this book and one of the other books that I mentioned, and that's Bob Sutton. And you can always visit Bob Sutton's website as well at bobsutton.net. Hey, Huggy, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Dolph, and thank you very much for having me.
All right, friends, that is our episode for the week. But before I let you go, I just want to make sure you know about two other episodes that you might really get value out of if you enjoyed this one. Once again, trying to remove that friction, we have hundreds of episodes you won't have to go through to find them. Episode 180, Creating a Strong Back Office with Sean Hale. If you want to reduce friction, create a strong back office. The other is episode 277, Make the Most of Your Time with Shanice Miller. And that, my friends, is our show for this week. I hope that you have gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And one little bit of friction in my life, because the lawyers always make me say this, I'm not an accountant nor an attorney. I don't know why I have to say it. We did not talk about tax or law or accounting, but I have to. And neither I nor the consulting practice provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. This podcast is for informational purposes only. So guess what, friend? Don't use it for tax, legal, or accounting advice.